Great. Just like to welcome everyone here this morning. My name is Jeff LeGros, and I'm one of the co-organizers of the conference, along with Mel Leffler and Will Hitchcock. I'd like to welcome our out-of-town guests. I'd like to welcome our virtual guests who are on audio here, and we'll ask them to speak in a few minutes. And I'd like to extend a special welcome to Carol Stevenson. This is the William and Carol Stevenson Conference, an annual conference that is supported by the Stevenson family. Bill and Carol have been longtime supporters of the Miller Center. Bill passed away in 2008, but a legacy that they both offered is this conference to address major issues of national and international significance. So thank you so much, Carol. I think what we're trying to do in this conference is to look at the sources and impact of grand strategies. Now, this is an old topic, but it's usually focused on great powers. And today we're looking at a different set of what we might call emerging powers, or I like the German term, the shaping powers, right? Because some have emerged already, right? So we're looking at this set of countries that is different, that is distinct from these great powers, and we want to look at the group as a whole to look at the causes of their strategies, the impact of their strategies in world affairs, and the influence those will have on the making of U.S. foreign policy. This, of course, fits the mission of the Miller Center, which is focused on bringing academic expertise to bear on issues of public policy importance. It's at that intersection, and the people who are here today represent people trying to work at that intersection, and that's the aim of the project. And what we're trying to do in this workshop, because it is a workshop, it's an effort to take an initial set of papers that have been produced, and to use the discussions to help produce the best book possible from these discussions. Harvard University Press has agreed to publish a volume that comes out of this, and we want to really produce something that is exceptional. So what we're going to do is we're going to take three sessions to look at the papers that are on the different strategies. So that'll be two sessions this morning and one this afternoon. Then tomorrow we'll look and use a session in the morning to consider the impact of these strategies on world politics. And then Jim Steinberg will present a keynote addressing how the United States should be responding to this set of emerging strategies and the world that these strategies are going to mold. So our panel procedure this morning is we're going to have each of our presenters hopefully present for 8 to 10 minutes, and then Philip Zelikow will comment on those papers for 12 to 15 minutes, and then we'll open it up for discussion. We good? Any questions before we get going? If not, I think I'd like to start with Matthias. Are you there?
I am here indeed.
Excellent. We can hear you perfectly. So, Matthias, why don't you kick us off here with 8 to 10 minutes on Brazil's strategy.
Great. Thank you very much. Let me start by apologizing for not being there. I had an ugly bicycle accident, my own fault, and they had to rebuild my elbow. So I'm really sorry not to be one of the present invitees there today. I will very briefly address the three main questions that the conference organizers sent us, and they are: how have Brazilian elites characterized global order, and what are their major strategic ambitions? The second question is to do with which leaders and interest groups and bureaucracies actually shape policy, And finally, what are the core factors that explain why Brazil does what it does in the world? So let me start by saying that there are two contending theories at the moment inside Brazil, and this is a very heated debate, and it is indeed the key debate shaping the current election year. We will elect a president next October, and this is very much what they are discussing now. There is one camp that believes that unipolarity is here to stay, that the system is not shifting significantly towards multipolarity, even if multipolarity would be better for Brazil, both in practical terms and in normative terms. Most Brazilians across the governing elites believe that multipolarity is morally superior to any other form of power distribution in the world. But there is this one camp that doesn't see multipolarity picking up. And their argument is that Brazil's core strategy should be a very soft form of bandwagoning. In other words, a very soft alignment with the core countries, what they call the core countries in the North Atlantic. There is a second group. It's the group that is currently in power in Brazil, who believe that we are seeing a very significant transition of power, that multipolarity is indeed coming to the international system, and that this is great for Brazil, and that this is the opportunity Brazil has to increase its own power, prestige, and influence in global politics. And the reason why Brazil wants this added power, the argument goes, is so Brazilian authorities can have greater autonomy to pursue their own policies, to turn Brazil from a backwards rural economy only a few decades ago into a thriving, urbanized, middle-class society in the next few years. This has, of course, a lot of implications in terms of the way Brazilians see polarity, the way they see regional order, the way they see membership in international relations, and the way they understand global justice. And I just wanted to say something very brief about each one of these factors. On the issue of polarity, there are a few things that stand out, and I think relate to the other papers, and in particular to the India case, I think, but also to China. The first thing I wanted to say on the issue of polarity is that from the Brazilian perspective, if multipolarity is ever to arise, this will not be necessarily a result of balancing behavior on the part of the emerging countries. Many policymakers in Brazil believe that if multipolarity comes, it will be as a result of changes in global capitalism, irrespective of the actual foreign policies of the emerging countries. The other issue is that when Brazilians think of a multipolar order, they do not wish and they do not expect the core institutions of the current order to die. On the contrary, what they would like to see is a stronger United Nations, stronger collective security. They put a lot of emphasis on the WTO and are very reluctant to accept any other kinds of trade dealings in the world. They want to strengthen the World Bank and the IMF. And to highlight this is, I think, very important because there is a tendency in the Beltway, I think, to portray some of the things Brazil says and many other emerging countries as either attacking or challenging the existing institutions, portraying these countries as spoilers or shirkers of the current order. And I think when you stand in this capital, certainly in the case of Brasilia, it doesn't really look that way. The other point I think it's quite important to highlight is how this reading feeds into a strategy to cope with the United States that is based on ducking. ducking in the sense that when the big hegemonic eagle flies around, you hide your head underwater. And you resist to some degree, and you may follow to some degree, but it's all very soft, because the costs associated with either jumping on the American bandwagon or resisting it altogether are too high. This, of course, is very problematic, because it's very difficult to be an emerging country and to want to be recognized as such, and yet prefer to keep your head underwater. To flex your muscle means that you will be noticed. And I don't think Brazilian governing elites have found a way to cope with this problem yet. Let me move on to the regional side of the equation for a minute. In the past 15 years, we've seen enormous change. Brazil has moved towards its region by redrawing it. It stopped speaking of itself as a member of Latin America. It speaks of itself as a member of South America. And within South America, Brazil accounts for more than half the wealth, the territory, the population, and the defense expenditures. So Brazil is very powerful in its own sub-region. And yet, in the past 15 years, with all this change, Brazil has not moved towards a model of regional power that is obvious. It has not adopted the German model of supranational bodies. It has not sponsored deep institutions. It sponsored lots of very thin institutions that allow Brazil to retreat back into unilateralism when it wants it. And this has meant that for Brazil's smaller neighbors, Brazil has been a big problem. It is not easy to follow Brazil if you're one of those neighbors. Let me say something about international society and membership, and maybe with this I can end, because my 8 minutes will be up. But when we look at Brazil's textbooks, the kind of materials I read when I was a student and that my students currently read in Brazil, the way we view the international system is very different from what your introduction to world politics 101 will be in the United States. The American view that post-war order, post-1945 order is open, it's inclusive, it's multilateral, and it's fundamentally liberal is fundamentally challenged when looked at from the Brazilian perspective. They see this order, and this is what my students read in their textbooks, they see this order as rather illiberal in that it is quite close, it's very hierarchical, the rules for inclusion are very strict, and the major player very easily retreats into unilateralism when that suits its preferences. So this produces, I think, two dynamics. One of them is the sense that for Brazilian elites, there is no point in being absorbed in this great Western formation. Brazil will not embrace the language, the rules, and the norms of that order without some form of revisionism. But also, Brazil will not reject that package at all. It's benefited enormously from that package. It's been liberal globalization that has allowed Brazil to emerge. And the key point, I think, to highlight is that for the Brazilians, a self-identity of having one foot into that Western formation and one foot out of it has paid off enormously. Brazilians think they can get away with a lot by being at the intersection, if you want, between the West and the rest. And that's why they feel so disfranchised and oftentimes offended when they are put in the slot of the rest outright, without having a chance to make the argument as to why they are, to a very large degree, part of the West. Finally, notions of justice. There are two main themes when we talk about justice. To a large degree, Brazilians want to see an international system where non-Western states gain greater respect and are treated on more equal terms. But you scratch the surface, and actually what the Brazilians are asking is not equality at all. They're asking for redistribution. They want the international system to recognize that Brazil is entitled to special rights, and I think in this regard, India and China, and indeed Turkey, have arguments that are strikingly similar to those coming out of Brazil. And on the other hand, they want serious economic redistribution. So the notion of justice that they have in mind is not so much justice as equality, but justice as redistribution. And provided they can insert some of that understanding in global governance in years to come, I think they will see themselves very much as stakeholders of an evolving order that might or might not move towards multipolarity, but that will be certainly more inclusive of these countries that do not fit neatly into the Western Northern Atlantic Anglo-Saxon, if you want, formation, and the rest of the world. And I think I will stop there, and I'd be very happy to explore other parts of the paper as the discussion evolves.
Thank you very much, Matthias. Srinath, are you on?
Thank you very much. Let me also begin first by apologizing for not being there, owing to an sort of unforeseen family emergency. I know what I'm missing out on not being there, but hopefully the discussion today and tomorrow will give me a chance to get some feedback as I look to revise the paper that is in front of you. Again, let me just follow this sort of format which Matthias has so nicely laid out and talk about three or four core issues and arguments which come out of the paper in line with the sort of mandate that was given to us. The first thing I would say is that, you know, and one of the key contentions of the paper is that India's external engagement today is very much focused on enabling its internal development. And in that sense, India is very much like many other emerging powers, still focused on creating a stable and conducive external environment that will enable its internal economic and social transformation. And the hope is that this transformation in turn will allow India to incrementally play a larger international role. So that's the way that the sort of fundamental attitude towards the international order is seen from New Delhi. Now, having stated this quite simply, when you start breaking it down into components, you find that there are a number of subsidiary sort of objectives, a number of different kinds of pressures, pulls, tensions, which come into play. I may not be able to get into detail on all of them, but let me just lay out a few of them which I think are salient, and we can pick up on some of the other ones in discussion. Now, the first thing to say is that, you know, India's, you know, and here I think that the discussion vis-a-vis Brazil is quite different. The first thing about India is that it is in a strategic neighborhood that is quite, that has high levels of conflict, that continues to see large amounts of international and internal violence in states. So it is in a neighborhood which is quite, you know, difficult for India to sort of operate. And keeping a secure periphery in many ways, it remains the first objective for Indian sort of grand strategy, even today as it was, say, 60 years ago. And the key difference in the last 10 years or so is the changing conception of what India's immediate periphery is. For the longest time, Indian policymakers saw their immediate area of strategic action as being confined to the Indian subcontinent and on the maritime side to some parts of the Indian Ocean region. Today, however, there is a much wider conception. Indian policymakers and sort of diplomats and bureaucrats routinely talk of an idea of an extended neighborhood, which encompasses considerable parts of the Middle East and East and Southeast Asia as well. So there is clearly an expansion in terms of what India considers its neighborhood, which it has to sort of secure in order to ensure peace and tranquility for its own internal growth. Now, in terms of The second sort of large component of Indian strategy is really to make sure that there is a enabling global environment, by which I mean questions about international order, institutions, et cetera, which Matthias already alluded to, which also impinge upon India's own economic growth and its prospects for playing a larger international role. Now, let me just focus on these two bits, on the sort of secure periphery and enabling global environment, and hopefully that will cover most of the basis of what the paper is talking about. In terms of stable and peaceful periphery, now, as I said, in the immediate neighborhood, India continues to remain sort of locked into multiple conflicts with both with Pakistan, which takes up continues to take up a lot of its time, energy, attention in diplomatic, military, and in other kinds of security terms as well. And as much as India would like to think that, you know, it is sort of now positioned to play a much larger global role, the fact still remains that the problems within South Asia tend to lay fetters on India's ability to play a much important role outside. And there is something of a debate in India about, you know, whether we can sort of ignore what is happening in South Asia and simply look to play a much bigger role. But I think the consensus today would be that, you know, that's really not possible. You have to sort of find ways of, you know, if not resolving these problems, at least of ameliorating them and then moving on towards playing a larger role. Now, as far as Pakistan is concerned, I mean, I don't want to get into details, but to put it in a nutshell, the problem really is twofold. On the one hand, as far as Indians are concerned, you know, there are two large factors which complicate the making of any strategy towards Pakistan. First is that you know, problems from Pakistan not only come because of the Pakistani state's strengths, but also because of its weaknesses. And here, of course, we all talk about non-state actors, terrorist groups, etc. The second is that the structure of the Pakistani state itself makes it quite difficult to craft a consistent sort of approach towards the state, partly because there are multiple centers of authority. We all know that the military and the intelligence in Pakistan play a very important role in crafting its foreign and security policy, especially vis-a-vis India, which remains an area of central concern. And over the last 10 years or so, the sort of key strategic debate has been about how do you want to sort of deal with the challenges posed by Pakistan. So there is a diplomatic track, you know, you want to follow it, but then every time there is a terrorist attack, there is domestic pressures which build up on you. And again, India today is operating very much in a coalition politics model, which means that you know, domestic political pressures tend to bear upon these kinds of issues in a much more stronger way than they did in the past. In terms of more narrowly defined sort of military strategy, again, the challenge of coping with a state which has got a nuclear deterrent but also resorts to subconventional, you know, activities like insurgency and terrorism poses very interesting kinds of conundrums, which have their own parallels going back to debates about strategy in the Cold War, but in a slightly different context in the subcontinent. I'll sort of move on to the other major issue which India has on its immediate periphery, which, of course, is the rise of China. Now, the rise of China, in some ways, is the central strategic challenge for India. Now, for the first time in its history, India has a great power on its immediate frontiers. This has never happened since 1947. And there are at least three kinds of challenges that the rise of China presents for India. The first, of course, is that there are unresolved problems, particularly over a very long and disputed boundary, which remain unsettled. Second, there is China's increasing footprint, particularly in India's immediate periphery, as I said, and which in many ways complicates the management of India's own periphery. And the third is China's rising profile globally, but more particularly in Asia. And the sort of emerging Indian strategy to deal with these various aspects really is a mixture of efforts at internal and external balancing, coupled with a deepening economic and diplomatic engagement. So what we've seen over the last 10 plus years really is a tremendous expansion in terms of India-China economic ties. There are serious concerns emerging in India about the fact that this tie, this economic relationship, particularly trade, is very skewed, partly because India tends to import a lot more from China than it exports. There are questions about how to sort of redress that situation. But at the same time, this it is a fact. You know, starting from something like $2 billion, today we are talking about a number which is closer to $70 billion. And it is expected to touch something like $100 billion in a couple of years. And those are all quite realistic figures to achieve. At the same time, of course, India has also made diplomatic efforts to resolve the boundary dispute, and a sort of fairly high-level political dialogue is on. But there has been some progress, but again, there are long periods when nothing seems to move particularly. Now, on the other hand, India has to look to sort of strengthen its deterrent capabilities against China. Now, as I said, this involves both efforts at internal as well as external balancing. And in terms of internal balancing, you know, India has sort of tried to undertake its own program of military modernization, upgradation of border infrastructure, as, and so on and so forth. And in terms of external balancing, you know, India has sort of developed a series of relationships within Asia more largely, particularly in East Asia. We see that the relationship with Japan, for instance, has acquired a kind of strategic salience, which was inconceivable without the context of the rise of China in the Asian context. Now, on the other side, as far as India's sort of Western neighborhood is concerned, the set of events that we sort of talk about as the Arab Spring, et cetera, have a direct impact on India, not least because that region accounts for a huge chunk of India's energy imports. There are about 6 million Indians who live in those parts. About $35 billion US dollars comes into India by way of repatriation, by way of remittances. So all of this means that the region that we call the Middle East, in some ways, is now becoming increasingly of core sort of strategic interest to India. And again, this means that India has to make a number of choices, particularly with you know, the onset of the civil war in Syria. There has been a increasing concern about sort of a new dynamic, which is more sectarian in nature, which divides Iran on the one side with other Arab Sunni states. And how India plays this sort of divide is going to be a very interesting challenge for it, partly because India's own interests at this point in time lie on both sides of the divide. So it's not going to be very easy to make an either-or trade-off. And again, in making these sorts of trade-offs, the principal concern that is driving Indian strategy is really economic. And as I said, to ensure that you know, the 6 million Indian expatriate workers who are working in those regions are able to continue to be in place. You know, in the past, India has sort of looked at doing evacuations in the event of a major crisis. But frankly, with the numbers that we're now talking about, many of those strategies are really not feasible in any serious sense of the word. Again, I'll skip over Afghanistan, which we could leave for a subsequent debate and discussion and talk about what is there. The second large point that I want to make in this paper really is about saying that, you know, apart from its immediate and extended neighborhood, which in many ways absorbs a lot of energy on the sort of Indian policymaking elite, there is also a concern to make sure that there is an enabling global environment for India to continue to sort of benefit from. And here, the relationship with the United States really has emerged as the most important one, notwithstanding sort of recent problems over the arrest of an Indian diplomat and other things which have sort of cast a bit of a blip on the relationship. I think it is fair to say that the United States remains India's most important strategic partner. And from India's point of view, a close partnership with the United States is both desirable and indispensable in achieving its economic and social objectives. And of course, there is a you know, shared set of values which underpins this relationship, which makes it you know, a lot more robust. Now, the relationship with the United States is also important in the context of India's strategy towards China, because China, of course, is the United States' principal sort of competitor, emerging competitor in the region and globally more broadly. However, India's sort of, you know, ability to deal with the United States in order to sort of, you know, as part of a larger strategy of dealing with China, is complicated by the fact that from New Delhi's perspective, it is quite clear that the United States, you know, itself is driven by two sets of considerations. So there are at least two competing trends in United States' posture towards China, or at least that's what it seems like sitting here in Delhi. One basically seeks to reconcile the United States to the inevitability of China's rise in the Asian theater, and argues for an American role as an offshore balancer of some kind. The other trend is to say that, no, the United States has to sort of, you know, prevent China as emerging from the dominant power in Asia, and that, you know, it has to sort of maintain a much more active presence. And U.S. policy sort of seems to oscillate between these two ends of the spectrum. At this point of time, of course, it's much closer to the latter end, especially with the pivot and other things. But again, from New Delhi's point of view, it is not quite clear that the United States is really sort of, you know, willing to give shape to the pivot in ways that will be meaningful for an emerging security architecture in the region. The other reason why the United States relationship is very important for India is because of the US's leadership in a number of international institutions and all the structures of global governance. Now, India's own approach to these institutions is driven by a desire to expand its own position and its role. India is not a revisionist power, and there I think you know, there does seem to be some difference with the case of Brazil, because India there is very little debate in India, for instance, about, you know, multipolarity versus unipolarity. India does not seek to radically alter the system in accordance with a new strategic or a global vision, but primarily seeks to uphold and enhance these institutions. Now, all of this is conditioned by the fact that India has been the prime beneficiary of the open global economic as well as political order that is underpinned by the United States' leadership. And of course, India's own prospects and are impinged by the functioning of these institutions. So for instance, in cases like the World Bank and the IMF and so on, India is principally trying to gain admission into key circles of agenda setting and decision making. Its strategy is to expand its role, not to change the system, as it were. Now, in pursuing this strategy, however, there is a structural problem that India confronts. And here again, I think India is somewhat different from, say, a country like Brazil, but has interesting similarities with China, which is to say that in aggregate terms, India's economic and political weight look quite impressive. And that is what underpins many of its claims to play a larger role in global institutions. But if you look at India, in most per capita economic and social indicators, India remains very far from being a developed, let alone being a rich country. In effect, there is a tension between India's core interests, which is that of a poor developing country, and the expectations that others have of the kind of international role that India can play. And here my colleague and former Foreign Secretary, Shyam Saran, says that India is something like a premature power, which I think is a useful way of understanding this particular dilemma, because it then means that India is often seen as playing a role which is at considerable variance from what the established powers who are running these institutions would want it to do. You can see this happening in climate change. You can see this happening in trade and in a number of other multilateral sort of negotiations as well. Now, the other point which is quite interesting from India's perspective is...
Srinath, yep. This is Jeff. Can you just take another minute or so? We're just running out of time. Yep.
Yeah, just the last point. The other sort of interesting perspective from New Delhi, when you look at the systems of global governance and this thing, is that there seems to be something of a curious reversal of roles in terms of what traditional IR theory would lead you to expect. From New Delhi's perspective, it seems that today change in the international order is not coming on the sort of behest of, or because of attempts by emerging powers like India to sort of, expand its role and so on. Rather, it seems to be coming because the established status quo powers are dissatisfied with aspects of the status quo, which is a very interesting situation to be confronted in. And from the Indian point of view, you can see this, say, with the World Trade regime, where there is clearly an attempt now with the United States to sort of carve out new kinds of regional trading arrangements, the TPP, the Transatlantic Partnership, and so on. Similarly, over issues like fundamental things about sovereignty, the use of force, R2B, etc., are issues where, again, India feels that it's actually the status quo powers which are trying to stay in the status quo. So in a sense, we are in a very curious situation as far as India is concerned, which is that even though India is a rising power, it does not really seek to sort of overthrow the system or even to sort of fundamentally alter its norms. Rather, in some ways, it is only trying to sort of preserve the system and expand its own role. And all of this, as I said, is being done in order to facilitate India's own internal transformation. So India remains primarily sort of focused on its own development, more focused on its immediate region, with an eye to incrementally increasing its role in the global arena. Let me stop there, and we can take up other points in the discussion. Thank you.
Thanks, Srinath. Hung Hua, are you there?
Yes.
Excellent. Great to have you on, and I'd love to hear your view, summary of China's strategy.
Thank you so much.
So we're getting bad audio. Are you near your microphone?
What are you here?
Are you? Yeah, I know. It would have been amazing. So Hung Hua, we're not getting you on audio very well. And there you go. Okay. So our backup plan for this is I'm going to give a summary of Hung Hua's paper. Hopefully he'll be back on in a minute. We'll continue with the discussion. Hopefully we'll get him on well enough to be able to ask questions. Is Mike or Ann here? I was going to suggest we connect to his phone and not to his computer.
Dan just went out to do something.
All right. So just to summarize Men Honghua's paper, he argues that China's moving from closed underdevelopment to open rise, and that China wants to be an exception to the rise, the historical pattern. Hey, Honghua, are you there?
Yeah, I'm sorry about the quality of the talk. Could you hear me now?
Yeah, we can hear you now, so have at it.
Yeah, I would like to explain China's grand strategy centered on China's national security. For many people talk about grand strategy from different angles. I think that grand strategy could be defined as the science and art that a country achieves its national security and its national objectives by the use of its strategic resources. So from this angle, we see that nowadays, one of the most important issues that the world must deal with is China's rise, just as we talk too much about China's rise and its influence in the world. Historical reviews tell us about the connections between the rise of great power and the war or hegemony, where China determined to be an exception. So since China's open to the outside world, it has integrated into international society actively and constructively and participated in the reconstruction of the international order as a responsible great power. So in our world, China pursues peaceful development. But we could say that nowadays, China's face a lot of challenges to its national security. So in summation, we could say that China faces a series of global hotspot issues in the field of politics, economy, and security, which are increasingly associated with its national security. For example, globally, China's pursuit of its security interest may have a confrontation with traditional strategic interest of the developed countries, such as the traditional interest of the U.S. in Latin America and West Europeans' traditional interest in Africa. So regionally, in terms of neighborhood security, as a strategic entity that has the largest number of neighboring countries and quite a number of geographical problems, China faces increasingly complex and severe security situation in Asia, especially in East Asia. So we could say that problems arise from historical factors, interest disputes, and strategic considerations. So we can see the U.S., Japan, and other ASEAN countries have a lot of strategic adjustment in recent years. So domestically, we could see influence from outside factors is flaring up. So as such, the following problems could be addressed in building a grand strategy. First, the economic-oriented national strategy falls short of comprehensive strategic designs, especially a lack of general strategic adjustment in response to the changing international situation and the perspective of China's development. Second, the regional arrangement of a security strategy failed to give permanence to key areas, namely East Asia. Third, China is in lack of a clear, well-rounded maritime strategy. So, fourth, China's military strategy has been subject to economic strategy, and military support has been inadequate in this regard. Fourth, China's lack diversified strategic measures and effective combinations of them. So, just because of this, we could see that there are so many scholars in China and LS. Call for the adjustment of its ground strategy and especially the strategic decision-making mechanism. So nowadays, we could see that there are so many talk about China's NSC. So it's a kind of orientation of China's ground strategy. So with the repeated development of China, its national security means more severe challenges. And it was high time to set up a national security committee in November 2013, the CPC Central Committee decided to set up NSC to perfect this national security system and strategy. So it's a new change, I think, that the build-up of NSC of China, I think that will follow the model of the United States and other Western countries, especially the United States. But it's also based on the institutionalization and the professionalization of the former leading group. It's called a Central Leading Group for National Security. So NSC of China will focus on crucial issues concerning territorial waters, diplomacy, military resources, economy, and the people's livelihood to make decision and supervision and implementation of national security strategy and response actively and effectively towards the emergency within and without. I think this is the first time, it's the first part of my talking about China's ground strategy. The second is, what's the orientation or the choice of China's ground strategy? China's ground strategy in the future could be generally stated as follows. Use domestic development as a foundation, constantly consolidate national strengths and turn it into international influence, maintain modesty and a peaceful mind, cultivate a responsible and determined character, grow to be a builder of the international environment, embracing peaceful development. I mean that China will not only play a constructive role, but also play some kind of role or reshape of the international environment. I think that for China's ground strategy, the theoretical framework should be that China put defense realism as the core. I think that many people talk about defense realism. In my opinion, defense realism stress on security cooperation and self-restraint, recognize the crucial role of international institutions, and hold national defense as a basic principle. The second one should be that China's ground strategy gives priority to economism. So economism is not only means domestic strategy with economic construction as a central task, but also international strategy of expanding national strategic interest with the economy as a major manner. The third part of this, that China's strategy should focus on regional areas, I mean that East Asia. For China, I think that China nowadays is a global power, but not a world power. I think that in China's history, it's never been a world power. For the future, it might be a world power, but now it's just a great power in Asia or Asia Pacific. So the focus of its strategy should be on East Asia. So fourth is China's ground strategy applies institutionalism in its integration into the global, into the world. And fourth, China's ground strategy pursue policy coordination. I mean that for China, it should prevent conflict of interest in non-core issue areas and to realize its strategic goals with a cooperative and a constructive attitude. And of course, China should pay more attention to its national image, that China should not be regarded as a threat of the world, but as a constructive, play a constructive role in the world. So the outline of the Chinese ground strategy, it should optimize its national strategy and economic layout. I mean that China should focus on its domestic development first. It should be the foundation of its ground strategy. Second, China should deepen its global strategy and expand its national strategic interest with common interest at the center. And the third, China should strengthen regional strategy and promote regional integration of East Asia. That China should not regard it as dominant of East Asia, but co-builder of the region. So the third part of my talking about China's grand strategy is how China should security its national security. So national security topped the concern of grand strategy for China. China has attracted wide attention and even infiltrations from outside, and this is more complicated security environment. So China first should participate both on the wide range and in key areas, with the key areas as priority, just as I said, that East Asia. And second, China should build an institutional security regime and a flexible partnership, but pay more attention to international partnership. Third, China should carry on international defense and cooperation, focusing more on the agenda setting right through cooperation. Fourth, China should stay away from both traditional security and non-traditional security threats, and pay more attention to non-traditional security threats. Fourth, China should enhance defense both on land border and maritime border, but with more attention to later, I mean that maritime borders. So there are so many disputes around China's maritime borders. Sixth, China should deploy diplomatic and mutual measures, strengthen diplomatic capabilities and coordination with the overseeing body of China's government. That's China should strengthen the development of NSC. So that's my talk. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Honghua. We're now going to turn to Philip Zelikow, who will comment on the three papers and kick off the discussion.
Okay. Let me apologize in advance. I have to leave at 9:45 because I'm on the committee for a long-scheduled dissertation defense over in the rotunda. The professors here will know how hard it is to reschedule one of these defenses once they're set. Rather than comment on each of these three papers individually, perhaps it might be more useful to offer several observations I have about all three of these papers as examples of aspirational powers, would-be great powers, defining grand strategies. I'll offer six observations and then try to give some illustrations from their comments and papers. First observation is all these articulations of grand strategy are mainly reactive, not proactive. Oh, the theory is that they'll observe the situation around them, they'll be looking toward the future, they'll chart some reasonable course. In fact, these grand strategies are dominated by the past. They are actually mostly sets of attitudes about the past stimulated by the past. In the case of China, its grand strategy can be summarized in 15 seconds as number one, consisting of a desire for economic growth, performance, and greater prosperity for the Chinese people, and number two, a strong China that can never again be humiliated as China was in the past. That's it. Those two principles are very well understood in China and are dominated by a historical narrative of grievance and how China will now rise and be strong and central once again. The definition of central, of course, is evolving. In the case of Brazil, as you heard, a sense of general grievance from being taught that Brazil has been the victim of an international global economic system in different ways, and a sense of desire to prove Brazilian independence in a world of other hierarchies, although Brazil's grievances are less immediate and acute, perhaps, than others, that historical narrative dominates their grand strategy and frames all their conversations. In the case of India, of course, the reaction to colonialism, the legacy of colonialism, and also the sense that India had long been a pawn in British global designs that weren't really in India's interests, and India will not become a pawn again of American designs or anybody else's. And actually quite a bit of inward-looking attitudes in India, which has a lot to look inward about. So my first observation is simply that grand strategies are mainly reactive, that they are dominated by historical narratives, and that therefore they have the character of walking forward while always looking backward. Second observation, the grand strategies consist of broad goals that are widely understood and shared, and therefore able to be popular and mobilize national sentiment and capabilities of these countries. But they are necessarily coarse and simple, and these grand strategies are not terribly useful as roadmaps to policies on any particular subject in the world. And actually, all three of these papers, with the partial exception of Mr. Raghavan's paper on India, illustrate this point extremely well. If you look at the paper on Brazil and you look there to find a roadmap to Brazilian approaches to political development in South America, say the problem of Venezuela or the Andean Basin or the crises in Argentina, you will read nothing about it. If you look in the paper on China for what China is going to do about Japan, North Korea, the South China Sea, Burma, India, Pakistan, Afghanistan, Russia, energy and the environment, global finance, world trade, you will find not a sentence about any of these subjects. The India paper is somewhat focused because India's environment is actually more dangerous than the other two. And the Indian paper does have a somewhat more concrete focus. But even there, it's very hard to find much of a roadmap towards India's future policies toward China, Pakistan, and Afghanistan, except the sense that India is looking for a way to balance different sentiments. So my second observation is that grand strategies necessarily articulate broad goals that are widely understood and shared, but in fact their articulations are rarely very useful. And they do not provide roadmaps for what countries will do. Those decisions and choices are actually made in much more idiosyncratic circumstances than can usually be encompassed in the elevated discussions of grand strategy. Observation number three. All three of these papers aspire and articulate the aspiration for a more multipolar world. There's clearly the implicit expectation in the paper that an American listener will hear this and turn red-faced and spluttering, argue somehow that multipolarity is bad or can't happen or America's still strong. I'm afraid that all these paper writers will be disappointed in the current American government and actually even in the Bush administration, which supposedly was so arrogant and unipolar. I think recent American governments and future American governments quite accept multipolarity. So the really interesting question about this point is, okay, is that all these countries want multipolarity? The answer will be yes. And the question will then be, now what? So you got your multipolarity. It's done. Everybody knows it's there. Now what do you want to do in the world? And here the interesting questions then become, so is there anything these countries think they need, Brazil, India, China? Is there anything they want to accomplish, any concerns in the world that they wish to address? Well, if so, usually if you want to work on one of these problems, you need some sort of agenda for action, that is, some sort of agenda of what you want to do. You need some sort of way of organizing the countries involved in accumulating the effort to do those things on your agenda. And you need some means in order to accomplish the items on this agenda. So accepting that multipolarity is a fact and these countries have achieved their goals, what do they want to accomplish and how do they address the concrete issues involved in providing an agenda or leadership, organization, or means to work on any of these discrete problems? I do believe this is a context in which the United States of America will therefore tend to come up again and again. But this also, I think, observation number three then is you've got multipolarity, now what? Actually then kind of brings you back to observation number two, which is that these articulations and observation number one are more statements of attitudes and broad goals that are actually not very useful in policy settings. Observation number four. Much of the discussion of political military issues is about things that are more symbolic than real. Now, this is mainly true for China and Brazil. It is less true for India. The discussion of political military issues in the Brazilian paper is really wonderful. There's almost nothing, of course, about Venezuela or the Andean Basin. There is, however, the observation in the paper that Brazilian generals justify procurement of naval vessels to defend their oil fields against the possible invasion from an unnamed northern industrial power. Now, I must say that articulating, say, the need to build the Navy to defend your oil fields against attack by the United States is more persuasive than saying we are building the Navy to defend them against an attack from Mars. So in this sense, I applaud the ingenuity of the Brazilian military. But I'm not really troubled by the gravitas of these political military concerns that I'm hearing articulated. In the Chinese case, there are political military issues that could be articulated about Japan and so forth. But again, I find that these are actually largely symbolic and mainly for domestic consumption. When I read statements in the paper, for example, to quote from page 7, secessionists and other domestic unstable factors are busy colluding with foreign anti-China forces, close quote, and that the United States outsiders are meddling by, quote, breaking China's development plans, close quote. And since the footnote then cites to Hillary a statement by Hillary Clinton, the notion that the United States and Hillary Clinton have sought to break China's development plans, if that's the statement of China's political military concerns about the way it's being threatened, it's hard to take them as more than symbolic and meant for domestic consumption. And indeed, I don't really want to quarrel much with statements like this, which occur in the paper, because I think the paper is very carefully drafted, and it's not very useful to try to quarrel with statements like this, which are common enough in the Chinese press, and which a lot of Chinese officials feel they need to say, and maybe at times believe, even though it is hard to find a factual basis for them. So, in the case of India, the political military issues really are real and serious. India, for example, was very interested and hopeful that the United States would be more militarily effective in Afghanistan than it has been. The paper actually doesn't mention how much the Indian elite has supported the American efforts in Afghanistan. You would get the impression from the paper that India has sought to stay aloof from that. Well, formally, yes. But man, do they care about what's happening. And also, I must say, one more point about the Indian dilemma is the paper, while it mentions that China is India's number one concern and then goes to Pakistan, does not actually discuss how important China is to Pakistan, how China is the principal source of Pakistan's nuclear arsenal and Pakistan's missile arsenal, and that Pakistan regards China and possibly Saudi Arabia next as its most powerful and occasionally faithful friend in the world, and that puts a certain responsibility on both China and in turn on India, which I think is is not adequately discussed in the papers. But again, just to restate my fourth observation, much discussion of political military issues, it's prominent, but the issues feel more symbolic than real, more addressed to domestic audiences than reflecting genuine international problems. The big wars of the 20th century had real causes, real wars for national empires, control of natural resources, control of huge masses of people. This is on a different level. My fifth point then turns to the political economy agenda. The political economy agenda for all three of these countries really is central. It really matters. And you'll notice in the papers, it's barely discussed at all. I find that very interesting and revealing. By the way, I think the papers in this pretty accurately reflect the conventional conversations about grand strategy in these countries. So this is not an attack on the paper writers. I think it simply has been difficult for these countries to articulate positions on political economy that fall under the discussion of grand strategy. Let me cite the example of Brazil. In the paper and in the presentation, it was stressed that all Brazilian school children of a certain age are taught that they are victims of a hierarchical economic order. That's a profound lesson to learn. So then you would ask, what then is Brazil's policy agenda for the global political economy that will redress this deeply held grievance now that Brazil inhabits a multipolar world? I have no idea what that agenda is. I knew what import substitution industrialization was when Brazil was practicing it so fervently in the 1960s and 1970s and developing the powerful state institutions of economic control that still dominate so much of Brazil's economy. But I could not articulate an agenda for Brazil in today's global political economy, either on global finance or on world trade, that would flow from this outlook. And indeed, I believe Brazil is so profoundly conflicted over how to articulate that such an agenda, it simply doesn't really even emerge into grand strategy at all, which is therefore a telling omission and about how useful grand strategy is. Sixth and final observation. Two of the three papers, the ones on Brazil and India, do spend some time discussing domestic policymaking institutions. Both, I think, adequately emphasizing the significance of domestic policy issues and factions in that world. The paper on China does not discuss that much, which is ironic because of the three countries, no country is more disabled by its domestic policymaking institutions than China is. And that's because in the Chinese case, China has a remarkable paradox, it seems to me. In the old world of political science, we would sometimes draw distinctions between policy and administration. I know more modern political scientists have tried to break down that old-fashioned dichotomy, but it still has some usefulness. The United States, I think, many Americans believe that they are sometimes okay at doing policy, but they are chronically poor at administration. I remember Steve Hadley once in a White House Situation Room meeting saying at the table, discussing some particular policy of some importance, "I give ourselves a B-plus on policy making and a D-minus in policy implementation." I don't think that those are uncharacteristic grades in the American establishment. My observation is that if someone in a standing committee of the Politburo was assessing similar grades, which they would probably never do, the grades would be exactly flipped, that Chinese officials could properly give themselves A pluses in administration. Let's say, build that airport on time, on budget. It will be built. But on policy, so many policies at such levels of detail are pushed up to the central mechanisms of control that those mechanisms are entirely overwhelmed by them. The Standing Committee of the Politburo, I'm told, has created something like 68 different committees to concentrate on particular priorities. Of course, if you have committees working on 68 different priorities, you don't have many priorities. You don't know what your priorities are. In answer to the specific factual question, did the Standing Committee of the Politburo approve the ADIZ decision of the Chinese government? I am told by people who have talked to senior Chinese officials about this that the answer to that question is no. That actually important members of the Standing Committee were surprised by that decision. The decision had come up through the Air Force. I am told it was signed off by Xi Jinping in his capacity as the chairman of a military affairs committee. But that the Standing Committee of the Politburo itself, which is an absolutely vital organ in China to avoid the return of Maoism, could not handle that. This policymaking weakness, by the way, should not be reassuring to anyone. To a historian, it sometimes seems vaguely evocative of some of what we read about the politics of pre-World War II Japan, in which you had extremely powerful bureaucratic blocks between, say, the Army and the Navy. The civilians were rarely powerful enough to tell any of them what to do. And indeed, occasionally they would say something and would be murdered for their trouble. And so what happened then is if the Army and Navy would basically cut bargains but mainly would just leave each other alone, and the Army would do what it was wanted to do, the Navy would do what it wanted to do, and occasionally they were forced to work together. But in this environment, policy agility or difficult compromises or moves were almost impossible, and both bureaucracies were prey to entrepreneurs, you know, the colonels or so forth, inside of their bureaucracies, who are attempting to force an immobile policy process to take action by creating fait accompli. So this picture of a central apparatus in China whose policy institutions are overwhelmed may not be reassuring, not least for grand strategy, but especially for the ability to make policy in a crisis.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Philip. And so I'd just like to basically open the floor here for people who might want to follow up with questions on any of the broad topics or any of the specific papers. I'd like to perhaps ask our guests on the phone, how would you respond and specifically to Philip's comment about the lack of attention to political economy issues, when that, in fact, is the central part of many of the things your countries are up to? Where does economics and the political economy issues fit in grand strategy, and why aren't they more prominent in your papers?
Can I have a go at it first?
Please. Srinath.
Yeah. Well, I think the point is very well taken, actually, because at least as I see it from India's point of view, political economy issues, as I said, sustaining India's internal economic social transformation really is the key goal even of India's external strategy. So to that extent, I mean, Professor Zeliko is absolutely right that, you know, India's agenda is quite inward, partly because there is so much to look inward, and that is absolutely a very precise characterization of what is happening. In terms of the paper itself, given that there were so many bases to cover, and partly because in the Indian case, the strategic issues also assume a certain kind of importance, at least in the minds of the sort of policymakers themselves. And as I said, these may be sort of immediate issues of the neighborhood, but in many ways they do take up a lot of time and attention. So maybe, you know, that partly is the reason why I devoted most space to that in the paper. But there is clearly a case for revisiting some of this. And possibly the way to do it, at least in this paper, might be to sort of look more broadly at what is the agenda, as Professor Zeliko was mentioning. And I think there is a clear agenda. I mean, it's not as if that agenda is not clear, or that countries like India don't know what they want or what they would like. Of course, that does not mean that they can do whatever it is that they want. Wanting something is different from the ability to sort of set agenda at the global level, which again, I fully buy his point, is something that remains clearly the preeminent role of the United States even today. And I suspect most sort of policymakers in India, at least, would very much buy into that. Which is why, as I said, I mean, in India, the argument is not so much about unipolarity versus multipolarity. I mean, India was happiest at the height of the unipolar moment under George W. Bush, so to speak, when the rest of the world felt that, you know, there was too much of sort of, partly because it worked to India's interests. Whereas right now, as I said, I mean, the problem seems to be that it is the established powers, particularly the United States, which is in some ways trying to change key aspects of the global governance agenda, particularly in the issues like trade, and doing it in ways that may be aimed at countries like China, but are going to have collateral impact on India. And that is a matter of concern.
Should I give it a go?
Please.
Great comments, really very useful. Let me try to respond by referring to the first three points. The first three points in the comments are that these grand strategies, if we can call them that, are reactive rather than proactive. They're easy statements that do not really amount to a blueprint, a roadmap for the future, and that for all the aspiration for multipolarity, the big question, what then, remains unanswered. And that's absolutely correct, no doubts about it. But if we place these countries in historical context, it shouldn't be surprising that this is the case. After all, these countries, all of them, have very little or no experience of commanding global politics in any way. the only countries in the world where you find visions and blueprints and grand strategies defined in terms that are universal, with rules as to how to produce a better global order, those countries are countries that have run the show at some point in history. It's very difficult and very rare historically to find a country with a vision before it actually sits at the very top of the global rankings. In fact, if we look at US history, and you guys will be in a far better position than I to comment on this, again, in the United States, this notion that you can come up with a vision for managing the world is relatively recent historically. For the largest chunk of US history, the attitude was reactive rather than proactive, easy statements, easy for popular consumption, but not very useful in terms of a vision for the future, aspirations that don't really answer the question, what if? And in terms of military concerns, of course, and the case of Brazil is particularly acute in this regard, because like the United States in the past, Brazil's external environment is one of plentiful security, not scarce security. So, of course, the language and the procedures that the military use are all to do with procurement, all to do with securing funding, very little or no concern at all with providing security. Brazil has 10 contiguous neighbors, but hasn't been to war with any of those neighbors in 150 years. Brazilian generals do not know how to go do battle because they've never been tested in that regard. And I think it's important to understand this. The other day, I had an opportunity to interview former President Lula, and I was asking him precisely how come he never produced a blueprint when he was arguing for the reform of the UN Security Council, whereby he called it democratizing the council. It was, of course, not about bringing democracy to the council. It was about getting Brazil a permanent seat. And his response, I thought, was very telling, because he replied by saying, why are you asking me this now? Ask me when we have a seat. And I think that that theme, problematic as it is, runs very deeply in all these cases. In terms of global political economy, I think the argument that there is no blueprint at all is a bit too harsh. There is a vision. It's a very weak vision, one that does not solve the problem, and it's a general set of statements about deconcentrating political authority in the IMF and the World Bank. Brazil, India, China and Russia, through the BRICS, are discussing the creation of a bank that will make loans following rules that are very different from the rules of the World Bank. India and Brazil have gone to great lengths within the G20 to try and argue for reforming the weights within the IMF in terms of voting power for these countries. Brazil has been trying to argue, and losing in the argument, of course, for a strengthening of the WTO, because it sees that bilateral agreements or trilateral agreements or indeed multi-regional agreements are a threat to multilateral trade governance, and they think this is a threat to them. Again, I agree with the major tenets. This is not a blueprint. This is not something you can sell. This is not an idea you can run with. But given where they are and their historical experience they have, it's perfectly understandable. The first degree in IR ever to be set up in Brazil is only 25 years old. And if you go through the master's degree on offer, there's not one single course on global governance. The very language that you can govern the world is so alien to the historical experience. And in that regard, I fundamentally agree with the comment. These countries are very much centered in their past experience, and even if they move forward, they are looking backwards. Whether grand strategy is of any use to try and describe them is a big open question. And I think in all three cases, for very different reasons, the domestic politics of grand strategy make it very difficult for any leaders to actually come up with a blueprint at this juncture.
Great, thank you. I think we've only got... Yeah, Hung Hua, can you just hold on just a second before you...
Thanks, Mr. Delicot, for his comments. Obviously, the way we talk about the ground study of emerging power, we should see that the transformation of the world, that's not only the development of the country. So all those emerging powers are under transformation. For China, it's a comprehensive transformation, I think. It's not only economy, it's society, but also its political systems. So that's the first point. So when we think about the rise of the emerging power, we should focus on its influence on the world. For example, their role in the reconstruction of world order. The second for China that it's time to change its ground strategy, because that before we work too much actually only on economic growth. Sometimes we call it GDPism. But nowadays, we think that for China, it's not only talk about China's social development, but also political reform and cultural development, such and such. So balanced development should be the future roles for China's rise. Third, that when we talk about a country, I think that each country has its similarities in the era of globalization, but also dissimilarities in the world. For example, for China, for its political system, it's quite different from most of the countries, other countries in the world. It's a socialist countries. But it's not a traditional one, I think. That is different from the former Soviet Union, and different from the that described by Marx and other scholars in the past. It's a peaceful one. It's a developing one. It's open to the outside world, and it embraces a market economy. So it's a new one. Let China try to find its new road for future. It's maybe some kind of, we call it the third path of such kind of development. So we should focus on the maybe the characteristics of different countries. Thanks.
Very good. We've probably got about a little more than 15 minutes here. I think it might be useful if people have comments on the different papers that we might kind of clump them just for a minute. So let's just start with the China paper. Are there any comments or questions on the China paper anyone would like to raise? Yeah, Jim.
So I have a question for Hung Hua. I've just come back from Beijing.
So this is Jim Steinberg.
And was interested in your comments about the NSC, because, to be frank, I have a completely different impression. And even talking to senior officials there, that although there's been a debate for 20 years about the need for a more coordinated, comprehensive policymaking process, that there's very little sign that this NSC is about that. And that what it appears to be mostly about is domestic security. So I'm just curious as to get your sense of where your impression of that is coming from, and what do you see as evidence that this is actually going to be a focal point, as opposed to the old leading group structure that's kind of dominated what little integrated policymaking there is. And I kind of share Philip's general assessment of that.
Great. Other questions, comments on China, please?
Yeah,
can you just say who you are?
I'm Yaprak Gursol. I thought that it was very interesting that the China paper mentions that China is feeling threatened by the erosion of its culture, that this is one of the biggest threats that China is pursuing. And I thought that this is an interesting challenge, and I cannot bring it together with the argument that China is now trying to integrate into international society actively and constructively. So how will that integration take place by keeping the cultural security of China intact? I thought that there was a dilemma there that could have been mentioned more or analyzed more.
Terrific point. Please.
This is Will Hitchcock. I have one question about the China paper that also links to the India paper. Srinath wrote that the rise of China is the central strategic challenge for India. How does China respond to that view? Not that you're speaking for China, but could you put that into perspective through the prism of Chinese strategy?
Yeah, my only point is with respect to
this
China. Eli Levitin.
Okay.
The distinction between China and the perpetuation of the single party rule, I mean, is I think quite striking in the sense that all of this is defined, I think, and less explicitly than I would have liked to see, not about China. It's actually about the perpetuation of the single party rule. And I think that that dimension of it is something that I would like to draw out, because I don't think that there is discussion of China as much as the discussion of the central party rule. It's kind of referred to as domestic stability, mm-hmm. but in fact the real issue is the perpetuation of the single party rule.
Sure.
Please.
Hi, this is Constanze Stelzenmüller from Germany. I'm curious about another omission in your paper, and that is China's attitudes to and policies towards Europe. We think we're seeing a fairly energetic Chinese policy in Europe, and it's not just about the acquisition of assets, particularly in some of the more crisis-troubled economies of Europe. There is a fair amount of, how do I put this, sort of, also, well, just cyber espionage, to put it bluntly, which is not at all mentioned in your paper, going on. That's becoming increasingly a concern for German companies as well. And I think it would be interesting to hear you explore what China's strategies are with regard to Europe and perhaps Germany in particular. And again, I did think that the increasing use of cybersecurity and cyber espionage by China is also worth exploring in general and not just with regard to Europe.
And this is Kimberly Martin, and my question is about the China-Russia relationship and Central Asia, and also how Russia is pushing China on BRICS issues. And so I'm wondering if you could just talk about how China's version of itself and vision of itself going forward relates to that particular regional security concern that comes not from the Pacific but from Central Asia and Russia.
Good, please.
Hi, this is Xiaoyuan Liu. Ni hao, Meng Honghua. I have a question about what you mentioned in your paper about China foreign policy changing from introvert to extrovert mode. I guess when you say introvert, you mean Deng Xiaoping's Tao Guang Yang Hui. Is there a consensus among Chinese scholars or policymakers that this Deng Xiaoping's doctrine is already over? So now China start a new stage of foreign policy, a kind of extrovert, or this is just your own proposal?
Great, that's a terrific set of questions. Honghua, you can't possibly answer them all in the 2 minutes I'm going to give you right now. But if you want to take a bite at any of them, please do.
Thanks so much for the comment. Yeah, actually, it's very useful for me to revise my paper for this kind of consideration. I think that for China, actually, when we think about China modernization, before we always talk about China's economic modernization. So after that, we talk about institutional modernization. That's maybe the state building. But for cultural modernization, actually, is layout. We think that if one China wanted to be finished as a goal of modernization, it should pay more attention to cultural modernization. That cultural development should be the focus for China's future. Maybe in some aspect, I think that the cultural development may be a pre-request for China's political reform. For that's maybe the focus of China's next 10 years reform and development. For the principles for China, the ground strategy, I think that the first principle is to the defensive realism, that China should seek for national security, but should have more self-constraint about its, how to use its power. And of course, it's a focus on the economism, but also it's a it should be realized that nowadays it's only a regional power. It never be a world power. Maybe it's a global power in some aspects. So that's why I think that China should talk more about introversal and extroversal. I mean that for China, according to Deng Xiaoping, we should keep low profile because that is a kind of philosophical principle for China. Strategic culture. But China not as a global power, there are so many interests in the world. Actually, China should do more. And of course, China should play a role as a responsible power or a stakeholder, not only of the United States, but of the world. And for China's regional strategy, I think that nowadays China should restrain itself in East Asia, focus on the regional integration of East Asia. Of course, China should have more and more connections with the outside world, even with Latin America and Africa. But the focus of its strategy should be East Asia. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Let's turn to Brazil. Comments for Matthias and his paper. Please.
Jim Steinberg again, Matthias. I was interested in your observation towards the end in response to Philip about Brazil's WTO vocation. I mean, it's certainly been the case for much of recent time that there's, on the economic front, that regional and trans-regional agreements have been very important to the Brazilian strategy, Mercosur, the Brazil-EU agreements. And so I guess I was a little struck by your focus on the WTO dimension. I would have thought, but I'd like to hear your view, that in some respects that Brazil has kind of been the spoiler in the WTO rather than seeing the WTO as a venue for doing things and seeing its comparative advantage in working in the Mercosur context, or bilaterally with the EU, bilaterally with China. So maybe you could just expand a little bit on that part of your comment in response to Philip.
Great. Other questions?
Yeah. Eli Levita here. I think that the question I posed to Matthias, hi, Matthias.
Easy.
If this was written 5 years ago, it clearly would have communicated, I think in all cases of all three, rising powers and expect things to flow from that. 5 years later, they all look weak on some aspects. How is that transformation over the last 5 years affected what they consider to be aspirational? Are they clinging on more to the same stuff? Are they trying harder on some other issues?
Great. Other comments, questions? Yeah, hold on.
I got one for you, Matthias. It's Will Hitchcock, one of the Troika, putting this thing together. I thought your comment that only great powers who have been great powers for a long time have a habit of thinking about grand strategy because they have a historic practice of exercising great power, grand power. It's very interesting, but I also think it's a bit of a dodge from what Philip's criticism was, which is that any power, especially a rising one, with regional ambitions, ought to have an exercise, a process, through which it evaluates its ambitions and then identifies the means to achieve those ambitions. That's what grand strategy is. And you don't have to have been a great power for since 1945 to have a grand strategy, or at least to exercise the intellectual process that identifies your aims and then identifies the means that you need to achieve them. So I wonder if you could come back to that at some point and see if, you know, how you feel about that.
This is Kimberly Martin, and I was struck most by how you began your oral presentation, actually, in talking about the camp that still believed that there was a unilateral, unipolar order. And that is so not in line with the majority viewpoint in the United States, and I think many places in the world. And I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about where that viewpoint comes from and why it still is important enough to be talking about as one of two major streams. What is it reflecting? What are Brazilians seeing that makes them have that viewpoint?
This is Yaprak Gursoy. In all of the papers that I read for this conference, there was this implicit and sometimes explicit mention of nationalism. And in the Brazilian paper as well, I mean, I felt that this proudness, this feeling of justice and being proud of Brazil, I mean, you didn't explicitly state it as such, but I thought that it was very similar to the Turkish case, especially. And I was wondering how much of that would you relate to nationalism, given that Brazil in its composition is quite different than the other papers and the other countries in the conference. Would you say that there is Brazilian nationalism going on here?
Well, again, your time allotted is much less than the depth of the questions asked. So have at it.
Great. Excellent. Thank you very much. Indeed, the past 5 years have been terrible for the notion that Brazil is emerging. Many people are now arguing that Brazil is submerging. This has had an enormous impact on the terms of foreign policy in the sense that the current administration has become far more risk-averse. I think the peak of Brazilian activism was President Lula going to Tehran for the Tehran Declaration in 2010, and ever since, the willingness of the government in Brasilia to engage the world has gone down very, very dramatically. On the issue of the WTO vocation, I think there is a fundamental disconnect between how things are seen from the outside and how things are seen in Brazil. The reason why Brazil invested in Mercosur and South America as an integrated unit was on the argument that multilateral institutions are so skewed in favor of the United States and the real trade spoiler, Europe, in Brazil's view, that the only way emerging economies can have a chance is by uniting. But Brazil never conceived of Mercosur as an alternative to the WTO. It was a stepping stone towards having some leverage to negotiate within the WTO. So the Trans-Pacific Alliance now, for instance, represents the single largest threat from a Brazilian perspective to the future Brazil would like to see. On the issue of grand strategy, I take Will's point entirely. I think Zelikov's comment was to the effect that if Brazil has a grand strategy, that grand strategy tells us nothing about the future of global order. And I agree with that. Now, I wouldn't go as far as saying that the Brazilians have not come up with notions of goals and means. On the contrary, lots of goals and means in the intellectual process behind foreign policy, the fact that they do not amount to a grand vision of how to transform the world is a different matter. My argument was, I think, in my comments, that they were never pushed. They've got lots of geopolitical slack. They can afford to have a foreign policy that is largely capricious and that is concerned with the immediacy, the things that affect Brazil immediately. And those are rather small when looked at from the standpoint of big global order. Kimberly, your point is fascinating. Indeed, there is a huge disconnect between the terms of the debate inside the United States and the terms of the debate in Brazil. Every time I go to the US, I am utterly fascinated by this national malaise, the notion that the US is no longer what it was and that it is declining fast. Within the sector in Brazil that believes that unipolarity is alive and kicking, these are the guys reading Bill Wolford. These are the guys who believe that militarily there's no doubt that the system is unipolar and that economically the United States is on the mend, is getting better, and that there is a technological revolution to do with energy that will get the United States to the very, well, not to the very top, because it's at the top already. And the asymmetry of power between the US and the rest is so vast, the argument goes, we cannot plausibly call this a multipolar system, even if the United States has no ability to shape outcomes across the board. But then, if you read Brazilian history books, it was never the case from a Brazilian perspective that the US managed to call the shots throughout. When you read our textbooks for the 40s, 50s, and 60s, it's all about the inability of a major hegemon to actually shape outcomes as it wishes. And none of that is more true than the 2000s and the George W. Bush experience. That's how we read, and I mean we as an intellectual class within Brazil, I'd say, the kind of stuff academics and authors write about.
Matthias, fascinating, but I'm going to have to cut in
sure.
Just so we can give some time for comments on Srinath's paper as well, but hope to continue this discussion following. So India, comments on India and Srinath's presentation. Please.
Yeah, Srinath, this is John Echeverry Gent. I was surprised at how much you ceded to Philip's comment about the no political economy dimension of India's grand strategy. And it may be because it's not formally articulated, but it seems like one could read your paper as suggesting that India is happy to see its trade with China grow because it anchors China and reduces the chance for conflict. And then the look east policy of India clearly has a political economy dimension in terms of trying to expand trade and finance with eastern parts of Asia, which is not only sort of a security balancing, but it's an element of, as you say, sort of India's trying to create a global environment that would help to promote its internal transformation. So even though those may not be articulated as part of a formal grand strategy, they seem to be a very important part of it.
Good. Other comments on India?
Yeah, I wanted to. Eli Levita here. There was a big story in the New York Times, I think it was yesterday or the day before, about how the U.S.-India relationship is not only failing to deliver the long, I'm sorry Phil is not here, because I think it's quite ironic. That vision is gone. It's gone in both places. And so what I'm trying to understand is this whole expectation that the Indian grand strategy will revolve around a fundamentally different relationship with the United States. And 5 years or 10 years later, there seems to be so little of this, and to argue that it's all because one diplomat was arrested rather abrasively seems to me uniquely unappealing.
Okay. Thank you. Other comments on India?
I'll just add one more to the mix. Will Hitchcock. You had spoken, and this has come up a little bit, about the importance of domestic politics in shaping the making of strategy. And you had said in your paper, the signal feature of Indian politics over the rise of the past two decades has been the rise of coalition politics. And I just wondered if you could, you didn't go very far with this idea in the paper, but it strikes me as an important one. To what extent is coalition politics making the crafting of strategy more difficult? I think you imply that, you state that, but maybe you could evaluate that a little bit further. It is an issue that comes up a great deal in some of the other papers, so it'll be nice to see the points of comparison. Thank you.
Other comments or questions on the India paper? Yeah, please.
Yeah, I'd just like to ask you, Svina. This is Mel Leffler. Could you, your paper seems to illuminate strategy more clearly, actually, than the other two papers. But you don't really illuminate the strategy making process, if there is one. Could you tell us a little bit more about that process?
And a final comment.
Sorry, this is Constanza in Virginia. We're at spring, by the way. You're really missing something, all of you. my parents were actually living in India for 5 years, and so I called it home for 5 years. And I in the '80s, and I remember one of the huge factors in Indian foreign policy at the time, of course, was its relationship with the Soviet Union, which it expertly played off against its relationship with America. Where is India's relationship with Russia these days?
Good. So there's a set of comments, and you have, let's see what time it is. We'll give you a couple minutes, Srinath.
All right. Okay, thanks. Thank you very much for these comments. I think they're very useful. John, a quick point. I was concurring with Philip Zelikow in his observation that there was not enough of political economy in my paper, not in Indian strategy so much. So I think, yeah, there is... That stuff does loom large, as you rightly point out. I have to sort of make sure the paper reflects it as well. On this sort of two other questions about relationships, which is the US-India relation and relationship with Russia. I think the relationship with Russia has now become pretty transactional. It centers around issues of sort of, you know, military supplies and so on and so forth. It doesn't really have that kind of thing, partly because Russia too has now become more of a regional power. And as two regional powers, there are very few areas where Indian and Russian sort of interests intersect or overlap. So clearly, you know, there is a bit of a problem there. In terms of the United States, I actually quite strongly disagree with the current analysis that the U.S.-India relationship is all over. You know, if you look at the history of U.S.-India relations, and there's a very good new book by my friend and colleague, Rudra Chaudhary, which shows that, you know, at every such turning point, you know, people gave up on this relationship. But clearly there has been a much greater degree of sustainability over a longer period of time. And I think what we are talking about now is, again, not so much in terms of saying that, oh, it's all over, partly because, you know, the really long-term overarching concerns which bring a degree of strategic congruence to the U.S.-India relationship are all very much in place. They are about, you know, how to manage the rise of China to ensure that there is a degree of stability, openness, and transparency in emerging security architecture in Asia, how to keep the current globalized economic system functioning and in place, and how to make sure that the existing multilateral system, which reflects certain kinds of you know, political principles which both India and the United States adhere to, remain in place. And I think these are long-term sort of challenges which will remain in place, so it's not going anywhere as I see it. On sort of the two other points about importance of domestic politics, I wish I could have sort of spent a little more time on this, but the fact is that the rise of coalition politics does make it complicate India's sort of strategy, particularly in the region. It's not so much on other issues as on regional questions, partly because, you know, there are a number of states in India which share land borders or maritime borders with neighboring countries, which then automatically mean that those states have a much larger and increasingly more of a spoiler role to play. It's true of relations with Bangladesh, with Sri Lanka, and so on. I'll try and bring that. On Mel's point, you know, this is absolutely something which struck me when I was reading the other papers, which was that I really didn't focus on the strategy-making process. And perhaps at some point, you know, if you could sort of give me some concrete suggestions about where in the paper this discussion could fit in, that would be very useful. Partly because, you know, the process in India is quite interesting, because from the outside, it seems as if there is no process. But there is some kind of a process, and the challenges are about how to make a system like that work. And in some ways, I agree with what Philip Zelikow said, that China has many more problems on that front than a country like India does. But it's something that repeatedly comes up. And you know, there is also this sort of broader tendency to reflect on India's strategic practice as being conspicuous by its absence. So in a sense, to say that, oh, India is incapable of sort of thinking grand strategically and so on. Whereas I think a number of institutions have come into place over the last 10 to 15 years, which do make it possible to sort of consider these options in a more coherent fashion. The question, of course, is how do you want to sort of improve the system? So I'll definitely try and bring in some of those points into the revised version of the paper.
Terrific. Wonderful wrap-up, Srinath. I want to just thank Matthias, Srinath, and Hung Hua. See you, Hung Hua. He just beeped off, not by his choice.
That was the
but
quickest.
It's been wonderful to have you with us. We want to invite you back tomorrow evening, your time, tomorrow morning, our time, to talk about the impact, if you can do it. We hope you'll join us. Very useful, and we will be in touch with you on the terms of comments to follow up on the drafts you've presented. We're going to take a 10-minute break now, and then we'll come back on the next panel. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Matthias, Srinath, and Hung Hua. You guys have a good night's sleep.
Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye.